Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today, I talk with James Taylor, an international authority on creativity based in the UK. We talk about working as a music promoter earlier in his career, how he got into teaching about creativity, the importance of storytelling, and more, all right after this. I want to thank our friends over at Jack Prince for sponsoring this episode. Whatever you need printed, they can do it. Do you need stickers? Jack Prince can do it. Do you need t-shirts? Jack Prince can do it. Embroidered hats, business cards, banners? Jack Prince can do it. They make great stuff at a great price. Speaking of banners, Jack Prince has their lowest prices on banners ever right now. Some of them are up to 70% off. I just looked up the cost of an 8-foot by 5-foot banner. How much do you think it should cost? $200? $300? More? You can get it at Jack Prince for just $70. While we're talking about great offers, let's talk about the fact that Jack Prince is offering a free silver ink upgrade going on right now. But it's not just on silver ink. If you're looking to get something embroidered, you can get free silver thread too. So when you get something printed or embroidered, now through the end of the year, add some silver ink into that design. If you love pocket-sized notebooks, check out Jack Prince Pocket Notes. They come with tons of great options, making them perfect for gifts, giveaways, branding, and custom office supplies. Custom pocket notebooks are sized for quick sketching and note-taking. Plus, unlike other printers who, you know, make you design around their logo and have all those parameters like that, Jack Prince builds their custom notebooks from the ground up, giving you the entire cover to customize in vivid full color. Jack Prince makes great, affordable stuff for designers like you and I. They focus on quality and customer service and have been loyal Creative South sponsors for years. Why not pick them next time you need stickers, banners, or pocket notebooks printed? Plus, Jack Prince is giving you a great discount. You can save up to $75 on your next order. Just use promo code CS16podcast at checkout or visit jack.ink/design. Are you ready to explore your creativity and meet a ton of new friends while you're doing it? Then head over to creativesouth.com right now and get your Creative South tickets. Join us April 6th through 9th in Columbus, Georgia for Creative South, where you come as friends and leave as family. If you like the podcast and want to help support us, head over to patreon.com/creativesouth. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. Plus, when you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts, and you can even get your own podcast episode. So please, help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. So, James, thank you for joining me this morning.
Well, it's very nice to speak to you, although we're on the other different sides of the pond today, speaking to each other, but it's nice, it's great.
Yeah, and we were just talking, you guys are starting your, do you guys call it daylight savings time? What do you call it?
I get so confused. I get, you know, because I've lived in both in Europe and also in the US, and and I still don't quite... I should have like three clocks up on my wall so I can remember what time I'm speaking to people and thinking about it, but life's too short. So I'm awake when I'm awake. Let's put it that way.
That'll work. At least you got an extra hour of sleep today.
That was very nice.
That's the important part of it. So let's tell everybody a little bit about you. Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, so I grew up in an ex-mining village on the west coast of Scotland. Very small, kind of rural type of environment. It was all kind of fields, and it's, you know, a lot of the stuff that I'm known for now is very much online and a lot of kind of big music artists and kind of working with well-known creative folk. But where I grew up, you couldn't be further removed from that. I think in my class at school, I think I maybe had 8 other people in my year in the elementary school. Wow. And so it was very small. But what was great about that is, and I don't know, where you've kind of grown up, but growing up in that kind of environment, it's a very, very safe environment. Mm-hmm. but also you're quite outdoorsy and you're willing to kind of take risks, I suppose, sure. as well. And, you know, yeah, you're kind of outside and kind of growing up, you know, I was born in the late 70s, 77. So kind of growing up in the 80s, it was that really interesting time of, you know, things like Tron, like movies like that coming out and, mm-hmm. you know, gaming. Just, I remember I had a Spectrum 48K.
I just introduced my kids to Tron.
Oh, it was great. It was a really cool time to be alive. And, I've just finished reading a book, actually. It's a book called Ready Player One. And
I've been wanting to read that.
Wonderful book. And especially if you kind of were born in that kind of from mid 70s to mid 80s, it's a fantastic mm-hmm. read because it's all about the culture, the music, the games from that time as well. So I had a very, very fortunate and very loving family kind of grew up with. And but yeah, it definitely wasn't the cultural heart of the UK.
No, it doesn't sound like it. I grew up in a, I bounced all over, but for the most part, I grew up in a small town in Minnesota, about 30 miles outside of Minneapolis. Our claim to fame is we were the town over from where Prince lived.
Ah,
so,
yeah.
So that tells you how famous we were if we're the town over.
Next to. Yeah.
Yes.
I keep meaning to do that drive, you know, the drive across America in a nice mm-hmm. car, and where you stop at all these really towns that are famous for, like, the largest ball of string and things yeah. like that. I just think that would be a great drive to do at some point.
No, my wife and I keep talking about doing that, too, because, I mean, we've taken road trips, but nothing like that. There, we've done the north to south route from, you know, Gulf Coast of Alabama to Chicago.
Yeah.
But not the east to west route, which takes significantly longer.
Exactly. No, it's we're very being having also, I think there's something that's interesting about small towns and rural places for creative people as well. I was speaking last week with someone from Sweden, and they were saying of a country that's as small as that, and me being from Scotland originally, we kind of have this as well, where it's dark, you know, 6 months of the year, mm-hmm. And so people have to kind of get creative in how they do things. And I'm always really fascinated why, you know, places like that with often climates you don't necessarily think would be great climates can actually mm-hmm. produce very, very creative projects, creative ideas and creative people from them. Where maybe some places which are, you know, you think, oh, this is great. You can just lie on a beautiful beach all day. You know,
well, that's where I live now.
Yeah, you live in the beautiful beach. That, exactly.
But I grew up in the where you're stuck indoors, you know, 6 months out of the year.
Yeah. So. There was that famous quote, and I can't remember who said it. Maybe one of your listeners can let us know. And it was something like, you know, in the UK, we had like 300 years of uninterrupted war. And we came up with, you know, the Enlightenment, with, you know, the Industrial Revolution, like all these incredible inventions. And mm-hmm. then Switzerland had 300 years of uninterrupted peace, and mm-hmm. they came up with the cuckoo clock. And so there's something about, you know, that just being places, and there's a wonderful book out about that just now, about creative, what makes creative cities, creative countries. And there is actually having a little bit of grit in there as well, is actually very useful for innovation.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. So growing up, you know, since you were in a small town, you know, what were you doing creativity-wise?
Yeah, so growing up in a small town, it was very much, you know, often in those kind of environments, the two ways that you get out of the place is either through the arts and music or through sport. Mm-hmm. So my family, the background of my family, they'd either been boxers, like bare fist, you know, like what you would call today, you know, the UFC, the Ultimate Fight, you know, that yeah, type of stuff. Yeah. Either they'd come from that world or they'd come from being professional musicians. And not being a fan of blood, I chose the musician option. So I got really into playing drums very, very early and got into lots of, you know, bands and got into music and things. And as time progresses, just as I kind of went to college, and I was almost going to actually go to Berklee School of Music up in Boston.
Oh, and, good one. Expensive
and,
one.
Yeah, and at the last minute, and I was my father's a professional jazz musician, and I was talking to him about it, and I was saying, do you think you should do this? And he said, well, if you genuinely want to be, you know, get really good at this, college is wonderful, but you might be better just going to a place where you can just play with lots of people that are much better than you and just doing it that way. You'll save a whole bunch of college fees, and also it's just a different type of environment, and you'll be much up to speed. Because a lot, as we know, a lot of people that go into those types of colleges, the ones that often go on to do very well in their careers don't often complete those courses.
Sure.
So you know, many of the people I know that have done really well have come out of music colleges. They've left after the first year. So okay, I thought that's what I'm going to do. And my interest was actually, I kind of took a little bit of a change of my passion was it's always been kind of really around music and creativity and the arts. But I moved from just wanting to be a drummer to a couple of friends asked me, you know, if we'd get together and start promoting club nights, bands, and then dance music.
Sure.
So I said, I'm going to do this. This is a good way. And I think I promoted my first, now it's EDM, but back then it was like drum and bass and early house music, like stuff you get in Chicago and stuff. So I was promoting my first club nights around about age 15 in clubs that it was illegal for me technically to be in. And I just enjoyed that whole process of actually putting on events and seeing people having a wonderful time, having a great time. And actually thought, the buzz that I get from that, you know, from just seeing people having a wonderful time and just really going with the music and everything was more powerful to me than actually sitting behind a drum kit. And so that's the point I said, okay, this is what I want. I want to be really more on the business side of things and helping other people who are incredibly talented who frankly just have difficulties around the business side of it, get them to as big an audience as and just basically take them to where their dreams are. So that's the transition I made, and then I really just from there I just went.
So at that point in your life, you really wanted to be more of a music promoter than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, so when I was thinking around that time, it was it almost wasn't just necessarily just a music promoter. I was thinking about just the business side more generally. So you had obviously record labels, and within a relatively short period of time, basically from the age from being at kind of college. Where I did kind of start to do stuff around business, and then up until the age of like say 21, I rapidly started obviously doing live events, and then I actually met my my wife, and she was an attorney, an entertainment attorney, and she said, well, the problem with promoting gigs or agency or any of that side or even artist management is your client can work with you at walk out the door at any point. And obviously, you know, whether you're someone's a designer, you have that same issue as well. Your client can move on to another agency. So
yeah, I think we've all experienced that.
Yeah, we've all had that feeling. So what she said, and she was absolutely right, said you need to start creating some intellectual property, some things, some systems, some IP around your businesses and what you're doing. So that's where we started in moving into record company. Perfect timing, just as Napster was starting to come out and the record industry was just being destroyed or being changed. And then music publishing. So our music was using everything from Japanese soap operas to Oprah to lots of
It's a very specific niche there, yeah. Japanese soap operas.
Japanese soap operas is a real thing. It's a very cool
thing. Oh, I believe you.
Yeah. And so we just started moving into stuff around intellectual property, still within music and the arts. And then I just kind of, I don't know whether it's a couple of lucky breaks. I also started managing some artists that did very, very well. So you know, one of them was a band called Deacon Blue.
I know Deacon Blue.
Yeah, so kind of rock pop band. So I kind of came in at a very interesting time. They had their first peak of success in the mid '80s, and then they kind of gone away. And then I kind of met up, I worked with the main songwriter initially. We were working on a project. He came on, did a recording on our record label, And I said, you know, have you ever thought about restarting the band? He said, oh, we've had so many inquiries, but just never been the right time. And a number of things, we decided to do it. And we got them back into the charts. You know, they were going from playing relatively small venues, like county fair style gigs, to we did a tour. We were like doing like 6,500 people a night. Big tours, you know, all the tour trucks, nannies on the road, you know, the whole nine yards, because the band's obviously older at this point, so everyone's got kids and things, so it's a different type of vibe. It's definitely not taking drugs at the end of the night. It's probably, you know, nice cup of tea at the end of the night type of vibe. So did that, and then just started working with lots of other artists, and then I got a really unusual call at one point. this must be around 2009, from a gentleman who was one of the founding team at AOL. And after they sold AOL to Time Warner, he was a technologist. He was also really passionate about music, but specifically around how people learn music. So he contacted me, and he'd seen that my background doing a lot of stuff around marketing, music. He said, listen, would you be interested in coming over to California and working with me, working with the team on actually just creating online music schools, creating online, and marketing these online music schools? So at that point, it was a difficult decision. Do I leave the cold, wet shores of the United Kingdom and the grey skies for the sunny skies of California? It was like I was kind of on the next flight. So kind of went over there, and we just had a wonderful time the next few years, signing lots of wonderful Grammy Award-winning music artists, people like Nathan East, bass player, works with Daft Punk, Billy Cobham, the drummer that was in Mahavishnu Orchestra, some of the folks from top teachers at Juilliard and Curtis School of Music. We created all the top online bluegrass schools that you have now. I got to learn a lot about bluegrass music, a style I'd never known about before, and worked with top bluegrass guys. And, you know, we're filming like Steve Martin, the comedian, doing his bluegrass stuff. So
he's incredible, though.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. And it's great because it's kind of – and what I love about those bluegrass festivals especially – is you go to them and it's the folks that are going to them, and they're in their 20s and their 30s. It's a young audience, and they're really passionate about that. You know, living in the Bay Area as well for a while, we had the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, and that was just like a great thing. So we kind of basically just then getting very into online, and I love online because it allows you to impact people on a huge scale globally.
Sure.
And the other thing that's fascinating about online just now, where we sit in history, you know, we're probably of the same age, kind of coming up those first Spectrum, whatever, you know, Ataris and things. Where we're at now, and we're so used to it, having our Kindles and things, and our iPads, but in the next 18 months or thereabouts, another 3 billion people are going to be coming online for the very first time. So this is from sub-Saharan Africa, from Asia, from South America. So these are people that for the very first time will be looking for designers, you know, music tracks, online courses around things. Also, it's new competitors that are coming online for the very first time as well. But I just find that really powerful where we are just now in our history.
Yeah, that's I think the coming online and, like you said, new competitors, that's – For designers, that's a huge challenge because you have all of these places like 99 Designs and Elance and things like that, where you know things are getting subbed out overseas that to third world companies, and you know first world companies can't compete with that pricing.
Yeah,
and you know the flip side of it is generally you know you're paying for what you get with that. So the quality is lower, but it still does take a huge hit, and not so much on the pocketbook, but on the educating clients around what good design is, because they think they can go somewhere and get it cheap, and it's going to be just as good a quality. So that's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, and I was having a conversation the other day with Paul Jarvis, who's a designer up in Vancouver Island. Great designer, and he does a lot of design stuff for people. I just love his design and the way his mind works and everything. And we were having this conversation as well on the design side. And I use designers all the time. I have a full time designer in the Philippines that does some of our kind of logo related stuff.
Sure.
And then I have other designers in the UK, and I've also worked with designers in the US. And what he was saying from his perspective, you know, saying how to get booked and how to get work, he really niches down to the point where for many people that would be, for a designer, that might be uncomfortable niching that far down. But he knows that because the work he does, first of all, the quality is very good. And he knows when he starts working with that group of people, they all speak with each other in that world.
Yes, very much so.
So once you get known for that kind of thing, and his waiting list is, you know, 6 months a year, and I'm sure he commands really good rates for that as well. So I think for a lot of the good designers, regardless of where they are in the world, I think that the niching thing is very powerful. And it's just like, it's in everything. I just find it really, the other day I was talking with some folks from, and I always mispronounce it, is IDEO. I can never, IDEO.
IDEO.
IDEO. That's always been a
like, like IDEO with an O at the end.
Yeah, I always mispronounce it. And I was talking to one of the team there about their process for how they think about designing and working with clients. And they were talking to me about a chef that they're working with just now. Hmm. And that's about creating niche, like really niche brands, and everything being baked into that as well.
Sure.
And just the other, only a couple of weeks, I spoke to someone from Diageo, the big drinks mm-hmm. company, and I was saying, what are the big trends? And not being from the drinks industry, like I don't know anything about the industry. But he said, well, the big thing now...
He does know what you like to drink, right?
Apart from being a consumer, of course. But well, the flip side of marketing, I don't know anything about the marketing, how it's, you know, it has made any of that stuff. But what he said was that the big trend now with millennials and, you know, Gen X millennials is authenticity. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, where previously, like maybe our parents, baby boomers would have been around wanting, you know, those Smirnoff brands, those big... heavyweight
you want the big brand because
it represents trust and it's that's what it is. Now it's all about boutique, niche, you know, microbreweries, you know, that's mm-hmm. that's where it's going. And I think there's a huge opportunity from perspective of design and marketing, because in many ways when it comes to marketing, my background in online marketing, that makes life so much easier. Because mm-hmm. you could really understand your customer and your avatar. And it's like the hardest thing in the world I would have no idea how to market Ford, for example. Because it's just such a huge thing. I would, you know, once you start breaking down individual brands, maybe. And I think that's where the opportunities lie for lots of creatives, is that niching down as long as you can think globally mm-hmm. when you're doing that.
Yeah. Well, I like that you brought up the Diageo and, drink brands and things like that, because that's kind of where my passion lies as far as design. I love that packaging style, especially with the smaller companies, like, and you said microbreweries specifically. That's one of those that when I was in college, I worked for a waited tables at a restaurant that was a small microbrewery. And before that, you know, beer was just kind of the cheapest crap you could steal from your dad when he wasn't looking. Excuse me. Because, you know, as you know, here in the States, we're not quite as progressive with the trust of drinking age as the rest of the world.
It varies by state. It varies by states, doesn't it? The states have...
No, not anymore.
Oh,
not
anymore. Changed.
It did up until about, 10, 15 years ago, when Louisiana was the last holdout of a state to... Oh.
Of course, 18. Of course, having New Orleans there, that makes sense.
Yeah, so that was great when I was starting off college, because my parents had just moved down to this area, so I could go over to New Orleans and drink till I blacked out, basically, as every responsible teenager who has gets a beer does. You don't know how to moderate, but yeah, that was fun, because you could go over there and drink when you couldn't drink in your own state legally. So,
and I think I used to live up in Napa Valley, so starting mm-hmm. to work in that company that did online music schools.
Sure.
And they were actually based up in Napa Valley, which was awesome, because not being a wine person, I knew nothing about wine. So you got to know very quickly a lot of the really good winemakers, and you would hang out with them and stuff. And what was interesting there is that's a typical kind of, you think about wine. You think very kind of initially very baby boomer. That was the first generation that really got into wine, especially in the States. Now there's a whole range of incredible brands coming out, what they call negocion brand, makers and things, where mm-hmm. they're really focused on their audience and really having a good understanding of the audience. So it's not just the label. It's not just how the label looks. It's like how everyone's communicated to the ethos of the brand, the story. And from a marketer's perspective, the thing that always really fascinated me was, I probably have a upward of maybe a $50 palette. That's probably anything over that. If you gave me a $200 bottle of wine, a $1,000 bottle, and I've tried $1,000 bottles of wine, I can't really quite get those gradations for me. I don't have that palette.
I'm the same way.
But, you know, if people do, amazing. And so what's fantastic about those makers now that are making those wines, just being so kind of clued into their audience, and also really going for new markets that are opening up now, like especially in parts of Asia as well. And I just think that there's a huge opportunity there, as you know, when you start changing up the market. And the thing as a marketer I was going to say was that the thing I could never work out was sometimes I would see a $50 bottle of wine and a $150 bottle of wine, and they would taste quite similar. And I would talk to people that knew, like sommeliers, people that knew about this stuff. So why is the difference? What's the difference between these things? Well, and they would kind of tell you a little bit of the thing, but really, what I felt, you know, when you got to that level at that point, it was almost like the story that was the difference. Sure. In valuation between those things. Who could tell the better story about their wine, whether it's the provenance, about the winemaker, about the land that it was, you know, the terroir that it was grown in. What was the thing? And that, you know, story, design, marketing, I think that all kind of fits very, very closely together.
Yeah, well, and that's the part that I really enjoy about stuff like that. You know, kind of getting back to what we were talking about with that is, you know, I'm definitely a designer. I went to school to be a designer and all that. But through my career, I've built up to a point where, you know, design is probably the least part of my job that I do, and marketing is the biggest. And I really enjoy that. I mean, don't get me wrong. I miss being able to sit down with a pen and paper and just doodle all day to come up with ideas. That doesn't happen as frequently as it used to. But the figuring out the story behind things and figuring out that chess game of how everything pieces together to craft that story is the fun part of it, because you can, like you said, you can get into that very niche authenticity behind what creates something and what makes something good. And when you boil that down, that's where that loyalty comes from.
Yeah.
You know, product is all well and good, but a lot of times, you know, product A is nearly indistinguishable from product B. So why someone should use it and why what that story is behind that is what really drives that loyalty.
And I think as well, in the jobs market, they had the World Economic Forum this year, which in Davos, they put together a list of the 10 most important job skills for 2020, so going forward. And creativity went from number 10 to number 3 this year. And so, and like negotiation went down to number 7 or something.
I still wish I was better in negotiating. So,
but what's fascinating about it is, and I think this, especially when it comes to globalization as well, the thing that can often set brands apart, set individuals apart, workers apart, is that level of creativity. And the thing that I find very, you know, it's hard, especially, you know, probably many of the people listening just now will define themselves as being creative. Maybe the designers, the sure. artists, the musicians, the writers. So they define themselves as creative. But we're only, like, I think we're 45% of the population just now. Mm-hmm. Depends where you are in the world. But certainly here in the UK, 55% of the population do not consider themselves creative. Do not. In America, it's a little bit better. It's like 50%. So it's basically 50-50. So that you've got 50% of the workforce out there do not consider themselves creative. And I think that's a huge waste of human potential. And so my mission really now, what I'm doing a lot more kind of now, whether it's speaking or online courses or whatever the thing is, my podcast, is really attacking that thing, that 50%. That's the bit I'm most interested in. How do you get that 50% of people? Because when I go and speak at conferences, and maybe if it's like a big company or something, I was speaking at a conference the other day of lawyers, judges and lawyers. And
sure.
And I asked them the first question. I said, please put your hand up if you consider creativity important for the role of the job that you do. And probably about 90% of the people put their hand up that they consider creativity important. And then I said, how many of you now put your hand up if you consider yourselves creative? And something like maybe half of the room, say less, put their hand up. And then my third question was like, okay, so for all the companies you work for, the legal firms you work for, the agencies you work for, how many of them are actually investing in training and some kind of skills development around your creativity? Not your technical skills or what you do, your job, but your creativity. And it was like two people put their hand up. And those probably people were probably in HR departments or something. But, mm-hmm. you know, so I think that's a huge disconnect there.
What do you think causes that disconnect?
I think a lot of it is to do with education. Our education systems.
Sure.
And a friend of mine, Hugh McLeod, of the Gaping Void blog, great blog, and he's a great cartoonist. And he said it best because I sometimes I'll go and speak at these creativity retreats or events, you know, different places, and people maybe are learning an instrument or getting back to learning an instrument. And there was something I noticed in that audience that a lot of people had just hit birthdays, big birthdays ending with a zero, usually, or had a major life event or a divorce or some illness or something, and finally were going, okay, you know, I want to do this creative thing, to write, to create music, to paint, to draw, whatever. And what Hugh says, and I agree with him on this, and the numbers back this up as well, is that when kids go into school, they're in that kind of, before they go into, they're in that kind of pre-conventional stage. Their drawing is usually pretty abstract. Anyone that's got a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old, if they give them paintings, it's pretty abstract stuff in the fridges.
Yep.
The way of thinking is also quite metaphoric. They're open. It's that Picasso line. You know, the every child is born creative. A secret is how to remain creative when they grow up. So they go into elementary school that age creative. And then something happens, and this is what, you know, I suppose psychologists would say, they go into the conventional stage where they talk conventions, like, you can't do this, you have to do this. And that's well and good, and it's part of growing up. But at some point, we have to, as adults, we have to get to the point of going to post-conventional and saying, okay, those things, they're useful signposts, but you have to also break the rules sometimes as well in order to create new things. You have to be disruptive. And I don't think the best creativity can come from conventional minds. I think you have to, as a human, you have to develop those skills within yourselves to be able to say, maybe think outside the box or however you want to explain it, but just to push. And what Hugh says, he said he thinks that when people get to those big birthdays or those things where they say, I want to get back to that painting, that writing, picking up that guitar again, what they're really saying is, I want my crayons back. I want that thing back that gave me passion when I was a kid. And I think that you're seeing that kind of more and more and more people be feeling empowered to kind of pull that stuff back as creativity is becoming less of a woo-woo type of thing and actually something that actually has genuine economic value and value to us as human beings.
Well, do you think that, you know, well, let's just use the lawyers that you were speaking to as a point. Do you think since they have such a technical field where they have to know every letter and every comma and all that stuff, that they're not able to see the creativity that comes to crafting an argument and, you know, writing a, I'm going to use that the only lawyer word I know, amicus brief.
that's more than I know.
Thanks, Law and Order. We have 17 Law and Order shows over here, so that's the one that they throw around all the time. That's the only reason I know it.
Yeah, a woman came up to me at the end, and she said, she came up to me, and she's in the UK, she's what we call QC. So it'd be like you're prosecuting the person acts for the state or the government prosecuting.
Sure.
It's called Queen's Counsel here. So she came up to me and she said, what you were just talking about there about, and I specifically was talking about the 5 stages of the creative process, and she said, I actually teach this stuff to my university, you know, the university folks, all the people that are just coming out, that are just becoming lawyers for the first time. Because when you're prosecuting a case, and what you're trying to do is you're trying to make those characters as real as possible. And in your case, you're pointing out the person that's the person that's been harmed or something. You're trying to paint them in a certain kind of way. You're also trying to maybe paint the story of the person that's defending themselves in a certain kind of way as well. So you have to use creative because you're using storytelling. It's about storytelling. You know, there's obviously all the legal writing but some of the most creative, some of the best lawyers I've ever worked with and the best accountants you could say I've ever worked with as well are creative. They go into it mm-hmm. thinking, okay, so these are the rules. So we have to sit within these rules, and this is the law. So where do we want to get to? And is there a way of doing that? Is there a way of thinking about that? It's like entrepreneurs, they're thinking, you know, okay, well, this is what's kind of come before. How can I know that, you know, there's certain things that have to be done, but how can I tweak things? How can I just think about them in different ways? To reimagine what those things could be. And so I think it doesn't matter whether it's a lawyer, a designer, an entrepreneur, someone that's designing, you know, maybe that's working in a factory trying to think about how to get wastage costs down. There's creativity involved in all of that.
So, you know, follow-up question to that, and this deals specifically with creative people. A lot of us get into creative block because we spend so much time pumping out things that are creative that we feel like we've run out of ideas. Yeah. Or we come across a problem that just completely stumps us, where we feel like we can't be creative. And there may be jobs where we feel like we're not allowed to be creative. How do we get past that?
Yeah, so with creative blocks, there's a whole, obviously a whole bunch of different
thoughts
about that, and different people, very different strong views in different ways. I personally tend to divide it in terms of ways to get out of it, just to deal with it. Let's assume you believe it exists. Okay, let's assume that. So I think there's two ways. One is there's the kind of psychological, and the other one's the physical. So the physical is like the easiest one to do is like change your physical environment, move. That's just, you know, if you're having to churn out, you know, a high quantity of creative work at some point, you need to find a way to engage the other part of you, the physical part as well. Some people, that's cycling, running, you know, extreme sports.
Get up, go take a walk.
Walk. And what's interesting now in what they're finding in terms of the science of this is the University of British Columbia did a study where they looked at colors specifically, which colors would increase levels of creativity if you had them on your walls and your soft furnishings, things around you. And so what they found is the color red, if you have the color red around your screen when you're working, it will increase your levels of accuracy by a couple of percentage points. So it's good, probably, if you're doing your, you know, legal work or maybe accounting stuff, maybe this the red is going to be a strong color, a certain vibrancy of red. Then they looked at blue, and as anyone probably that's worked in any kind of creative office or industry, you probably recognize that blue sky thinking is going to increase the quantity of new ideas that are coming out. And so if you have your rooms, you do your brainstorming, your thinking or reflecting, you know, blue, especially vibrancy, a strong vibrancy of blue can be very useful. But then the University of Berlin did another study where it actually looked at a bit of a wider range of colors. And what it actually found is the color green outperforms both red and blue for the generation of new ideas, which is why it's probably a good idea if you're stuck, get out into nature, get out walking, because you're surrounded by green. So that's what's kind of, you know, it's not just green, it's the vibrancy of the green. That's why kind of going outside, you get that vibrancy of that green often as well.
Sure.
So that's kind of one of, that's like the physical side as well. There's other things that you can do around, you know, one of the things that's a little bit frustrating I see happen a lot is not so much in design agencies or design firms, but more in just general big business is the brainstorming thing. And how it's obviously it was a great idea.
I have specific thoughts on this, so I'm interested to hear yours.
Developed like obviously first in the 50s, I believe, up at University of Buffalo, so total value brainstorming, it can be great. Unfortunately, where most companies use brainstorming is not in the best way. Brainstorming is very often very very good for people that like to talk a lot, and like probably someone like me. Brainstorming is great for someone like me, but if you're in any way kind of inhibited or quiet a personality, brainstorming is like can be a terrible thing. So
yeah, you shut down.
You shut down. So you know, there's actually better exercises, things like brain writing, where you basically say there's six people in a room. Everyone, you know, regardless if you're doing any kind of brainstorming, should be given the problem in advance, especially for not people that are extroverts. If introverts, they can often do their best thinking before the event and then coming in and exploring in the actual room itself. So give everyone the issue, the problem they're trying to solve, challenge in advance. Then when they come into the room, let's say the six people, I think it is, like give everyone a piece of paper, pen, and you know, state the problem again. Everyone has to do write down five potential solutions or ideas for that. You know, after 2 minutes, stop, hand the paper to the person to your right. That person either continues with that thought, that person's thought that's on the page, or adds new thoughts of their own, and just have it go around. So there's no dialogue really happening in this part. But what it is doing is getting a whole bunch of ideas down very quickly, over 100 ideas, and onto a bit of paper. And then one of the other things I often see happen is you see this, what I call the tyranny of the whiteboard pen. Mm-hmm. You'll go into a brainstorming session, or you'll see a brainstorming session happen, and this one person has the pen. And there's only one pen. And they dominate the board. And funnily enough, it's usually their ideas that end up on the board.
I envision this Lord of the Rings scenario exactly. Around a, you know, the XO marker.
Exactly. So everyone should have marker pens. Everyone should have post-it notes. Like, don't, you know, it's just the base of, so there's little things like that can be very, very useful around that. And then there's just like what we call kind of creativity hacks. So, and I won't bore people too much with these different stages of the creative process. There's five key stages of the creative process. Is that preparation stage. So maybe if you're a designer, you're thinking about the brief and what the thing, maybe researching potential mm-hmm. ideas and you know, mood boards and things like that. Then you come to the incubation stage where you basically put it to the back of your mind for a period of time. Don't think about work on another project. And it's basically the subconscious doing the heavy lifting. Then you have the insight stage where you have this aha moment. Then you have the evaluation stage where usually a team of people, you'll evaluate the different ideas that are coming to the surface. And then you'll have the elaboration stage where you actually 99% perspiration, the working things up. Now,
sure.
Caffeine is a really interesting thing because caffeine can be very useful for creativity and dealing with creative blocks, and it can be terrible for it as well. We're caffeine.
I can see that.
So Martha Farrar, who's a neuroscience professor at the University mm-hmm. of Pennsylvania, she did a study on this. And what she found is caffeine is really useful at the first stage and the last stage of the creative process. So if you're doing your mood boards, you know, thinking, doing your research, all that stuff in preparation, caffeine's great. It's going to work. Also at the end stage where you're having to like just you know what you have to do. You just have to get on and get the stuff done. Very useful for that. However, caffeine is one of the worst things you can do at those middle stages. And she found out that caffeine, drinking high levels of caffeine, will actually reduce the number of insights, creative insights that you have. So when you're in those stages, depending on where you are in your project, if you're at those stages where you're just incubating an idea, thinking about it in the back of your mind, or actually doing something a bit more conformal to try and get, try and like reduce the caffeine levels a little bit, because you will actually have better ideas.
Huh. Interesting. I'm going to have to try that.
So there's a whole bunch of things like that you can try. And, you know, there's other things like creative pairs, streaming, editing, which is very useful, especially more, you know, a lot for writers. Mm-hmm. People like Julia Cameron expressed this in the idea of the morning pages in her book, The Artist's Way. So you're not trying to edit at the same time as, you know, coming out with things. So that's, you know, stream, don't edit. And I'm a huge believer actually in travel. I think travel is massively important for creative people. And when I say travel, it doesn't have to be to another country. I just mean traveling around your state, taking a different route to work. It just kind of, because what's happening often with creativity is it's like a record sometimes where, and this is what creative block is, this record where it's got stuck in a groove and it keeps going back. And sometimes you just need to give it a bit of a jolt. And travel is...
You're exposing yourself to new things and, at a certain point, you do run out of ideas if you're not changing up where you're at and what you're doing and all, because you've exhausted every idea that's around that. Yeah. So travel makes sense there.
And I think as well, I think what's also very fun, depending on the kind of personality you are, is, you know, this idea of creative pairs, you know, the Lennon and McCartney, the Bacharach and Davids, having someone else, maybe, and you have a series of these different people that you work with in that way. It can lessen the load sometimes, and it also maybe when you're working on a project, when one person's energy level is dipping a little bit, or they're getting, you know, they're just getting stuck in a bit of a rut, it gives you someone else mm-hmm. to kind of push you. And that's very hard, especially, you know, for the solopreneur, the solo designer, you know, songwriter, creative. I work with a lot of songwriters, and, you know, one thing I say that is like, find a co-writer, and just, you know, because it will just break you out of your patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can see that. I have a friend who is a singer-songwriter up in the Nashville area. And I mean, he's, thankfully he's not one of the people who's having to, you know, go out to the bars every night and play and hope to get noticed and all at this point. But he had a writing partner for the longest time, and he, by his own admission, like, some of his best work came when he had a writing partner versus when he's been doing it by himself. And so he's been trying to get back into working with writing partners. Not necessarily the same person all the time, but just when he goes in, he wants to write with whoever the recording artist is going to be and things like that.
Absolutely. And I think this is also, our media doesn't help on this, because the media likes to portray the idea of the lone creative genius, this one sure. person that's up there, whether it's a tech founder or an artist, whatever the thing is, this lone person. But as anyone that's done any kind of level of creative work and had any kind of impact, you know, it's a team thing.
Oh, so, definitely.
Often you will see someone up there, but there will be almost like a shadow artist, another person that's there. You know, even going back to people like Charles Darwin, you know, the writer, you know, talking about evolution and things. You know, it was mm-hmm. his wife was massively influential in his stuff, but she never gets any credit because it didn't work with the narrative, the story. And the narrative of the media really love this idea of this single person. It just works for them. And that goes back to a gentleman called Giorgio Vasari back in the Renaissance, who mm-hmm. wanted to change up the concept of what a creative genius is. Because the idea that we understand a creative genius now as being an individualist thing, that's not actually always been the way that people have actually thought about creativity and creative genius.
Yeah, well, look at Mozart and Salieri.
Yeah. And also a bit of competition.
I mean, they wrote together all the time.
A bit of competition.
And they had that competition.
Exactly.
Now, granted, maybe you shouldn't get to the point where you're, you know, pulling what Salieri did to Mozart.
No, probably not. Probably not. That's not really, I wouldn't advise that anyone.
Well, it's not healthy for either party there.
No.
Especially Mozart.
No, especially Mozart.
Yes.
Although we got a great movie out of it, so.
Yes. Amadeus is still one of my favorite movies. To date ourselves there, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
So, excuse me. So moving forward with, you know, the creativity process of, you know, you get past the writing partners and you get past the brainstorming stage and all that. What's next for people to find those bursts of, or not necessarily bursts of creativity, but stay on task. I think that's one of the harder things, is staying on task. Because yeah. as creative people, our minds tend to wander and think of other creative endeavors while we're doing things.
I think actually the best advice this kind of evaluation stage in the creative process, stage four. And it's iterative as well. You're always feeling this, like the bright, shiny thing will come up, some new bit of technology or new thing. Someone else is doing something. Oh, I have to jump on that. And so I think actually the best advice I've ever heard about this particular problem actually comes from Warren Buffett, strangely enough.
Really?
Not the person you would expect when thinking about creativity. But
I don't know. He's made billions of dollars. He's got to be some creative thinking.
He's very creative financially,
there.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So he was asked, he has his private pilot, as you do, mm-hmm. and his private pilot asked him, he'd been with him for maybe 10, 15 years, and said, Mr. Buffett, I'm thinking about starting this other business and I just wanted to think, you know, the best way of doing it. And any advice that you'd have about goal setting and, you know, setting goals and achieving goals. And Warren Buffett thought for a second. He said, okay, this is what you need to do. Get a piece of paper, write down everything that you want to achieve. In this case, it was the business over the next, or the profession, the next 5 years, and write down like 25 mm-hmm. things. You know, in what you want to do over the next 5 years in your profession, your business, where you want to get to, you know, if it's awards you want to get to, or income levels, or certain things you want to be, you know, to kind of clients you want to have, write those down. Now what I want you to do is I want you to circle the five top ones, the five most important. So you did that. And then, so that's obviously a very common kind of goal setting type of thing. But what he said next was, I think, the difference. And so what Warren Buffett said to the pilot, said, well, now tell me how you're going to tackle your tasks and your goals. And the pilot said, well, what I'm going to do is I'll obviously focus on those five ones, but then these other 20, I'll just try and, if time I can get in, I'll try and work on those, maybe on the side at weekends and different things and, you know, and whatnot. And Warren Buffett stopped him and said, that's where you're wrong. Because your that 20 that are left, the 20 that weren't circled, that you didn't circle, those are your under no condition will I attempt to achieve those goals over the next 5 years. Now, that takes a huge amount of discipline to do that, to be able to say, you know, because these are things you obviously you want, but to recognize you only have a limited amount of time and bandwidth to be able to do stuff. So to be able to say, okay, I'm just going to focus on these five. These are the five that are most important to me. And anything else has to get, you know, it can maybe happen in year six, if that's the case. But in this next 5 year period, this is what's important. I think that's a huge one.
Your bottom 20, just completely ignore them. They don't exist anymore.
Just ignore them. And he said, almost to the point, he said, they're your under no condition one. So it's not like you're doing, you just be like, you know that they're false friends. And you know, you just have to be, you know, wary of things that are coming up. And I think this is really hard for certain types of creatives who and I would count myself amongst that as well. Who you see something new and you're like, oh, that looks amazing. I want to jump on.
I'm the same way.
I want to jump on that. That looks really cool. And you just have to you just have to be kind of recognize that as in your personality. And, and think about how to kind of deal with that. And there are times, you know, those five things you might have, a new thing might come out and think, oh, that's great. Well, how can that serve that one of those five goals? And that can be useful. But for a lot of other new things that are coming up all the time, you just have to say, okay, they're not part of my plan.
Okay, that makes sense.
But it's hard. So, saying it to you, doing it is really
My OCD brain right now is trying to think of like five things or the top 25 things that I have. And then, well, trying to find reasons why I don't need to push those other ones away.
And there's a wonderful book. If you want to learn more about that stuff, Greg McCarron wrote a book called Essentialism, which is a really beautiful book.
You're the second person I've talked to this week that has mentioned that book.
It's a great book. And I especially think designers and artists will get this book. Because it's about a kind of a brevity of being able to do things, to say things, and it's a really approach. I mean, I loved, like, you know, Thoreau's Walden and books like that. And if you have that type of personality,
so light reading,
yeah, exactly. So if you have that, like, if you like that kind of stuff, then you'll check out Essentialism. It's a great read.
I'm going to have to check that one out, especially since I've gotten two recommendations in the same week
for
it.
That's, there you go.
That's a good reason to look into it. Kind of like you mentioned earlier, now I can't remember if it was before we hopped on mic or not, about Ready Player One.
Yeah, that's a wonderful book. And that's another one, like you said, sometimes you hear books recommended a number of times, and that's when I can normally know, like you, I can, okay, I need to check this out. And that was recommended to me by a designer, actually, by a games designer who... was the lead designer on World of Warcraft.
Oh, okay.
And I had him on my podcast a while back, and we were just talking about stuff and things, and he said, oh, you've got to read this book. And then since I've read it, you know, since I first had that conversation, a number of other people had conversations with me about it, and I know, I believe now it's been picked up. It's been optioned by Steven Spielberg, so I think there's a movie in there that makes for it.
Yeah, I did know that. I'm enough of a movie nerd that I keep up with stuff like that, and I had heard of the book before then, and that solidified I need to read it. So, cool. So, since you mentioned your podcast, let's talk about that a little bit. What do you cover on your podcast?
Yeah, so the thing I was interested in doing with the podcast is, we mentioned that, you know, the lone creative genius concept was kind of starting to break that down a little bit. When I interview guests, and they're folks from very different areas, everyone from, we have obviously have some musicians we interview, we have designers, artists, a lot of authors, entrepreneurs, leading academics, scientists, and what we essentially, the conversation I have with them is talk a little bit about their life, but really what I'm interested in is talking about their creative process, and how they generate ideas, how they stay on top creatively as well, and the people, mm-hmm. how they work with other people, teams of people, to affect change creatively. So that's it's called the Creative Life Podcast. You can check it out. Go on to iTunes and the interwebs to find that out as well. and it's great because for me, I do two episodes a week, and I also mm-hmm. do a video episode, which is like a tip of the week around creativity. You know, might be talking about creativity hacking. But what I love about doing the interviews is I'm sitting there listening to these people talk and talk about their world, and I feel like I'm getting another college education. I'm getting this incredible knowledge and insight from people that I think is great. I'm a big fan of podcasts because you can listen to them while you're out walking, running, mm-hmm. anything as well. So it's good. It's really good fun to create the podcast, and I just have a. I find it fascinating speaking to these people.
Gotcha. That's for me with this podcast. It was a way for me to keep on with something. I mean, this all spawned from the Creative South conference, and I had a friend who does podcasts. He has his own podcast studio where he records other podcasts. And he'd been pushing me to kind of, you know, come up with my own. And I was like, I can't think of anything that, you know, I would talk about. Like, I couldn't think of what my voice would be behind it. And it just dawned on me one time, you know, it'd probably be better for me just to talk to other people so I could figure out what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
And then then the second thought was, well, I already talk to these people almost every day. Why don't I just start talking to other designers who I'm already friends with? And then it's expanded, you know, from there where I'm talking to, you know, people like you across the pond who I've, you know, never met before aside from on Skype here today. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say what's nice about it. I think Austin Kleon talks about this as well. This idea of show your work mm-hmm. as you're working on something. And for me, I knew that I wanted to do something next around creativity. And my background is online courses, so I started to do online courses and doing a lot of speaking around creativity and starting to do some our own live events. And so I knew that I needed to learn a lot about creativity in a small period of time. Sure. And I thought, well, why don't I just like share this learning as I'm doing it? So apart from all the reading that I do around this area and staying up with the research, interviewing people at the top of their game, doing their creative work, like what if I could just like, instead of just doing those, like calling up those people and having conversations and asking them to do it, like just record it and everyone else gets to kind of share in the process. Well, and so that kind of goes,
that's exactly what mine was.
Yeah. And so people kind of, when I first started doing it, it was fascinating because I had zero profit motive for doing it. I still have actually for the podcast is anyone said, it's not really a profit orientated thing. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was about learning and then sharing that learning with other people. And some guests I had on, they said, so what's the podcast? So what's the reason for doing the podcast? You know, are you selling something? I said, well, no, I'm not really selling. I don't have a product to sell.
I've had a hard time booking some guests because they don't understand the reason.
Yeah.
It's because people want to have a conversation and hear from other people who are like them.
Yeah.
And that pitch is on some people is just falls flat.
Yeah. Yes. And there is obviously a whole network of certain podcasts you will go on, and it's a pitch of stuff. Mm-hmm. And some of them are actually very good, and it's very useful the way that they're constructed. But I knew that for my own podcast, that's not my personality. So I didn't want to kind of go that way. I just wanted more conversational and mm-hmm. it has a structure. It definitely has a set structure. And because otherwise my editing team, I have a team in the Philippines, do all the editing and everything. They would probably go insane if there wasn't some kind of structure that they could work with.
Oh, I'm going to have to talk to you about your editing team after that, because I need to find an editing team so I'm not having to do it all myself.
Yeah. But this is fascinating. It's that idea of the team. And so people are maybe seeing me as the face of a podcast.
Sure.
But I'm just one of five people. I just happen to be the voice or the face of the thing. But, you know, I've got a designer there working on the design stuff. We have a video editor. We have the person invites all the guests, brings the guests on. We have someone, a proofreader, someone that checks all the stuff as well, and we have another person. So it's there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's so, you know, we going back to the top 25 goals and five goals is like I sat down a while back with the podcast itself and wrote out what my top 10 were. And I circled like the top three that I wanted to get accomplished in this year. And obviously it doesn't make sense for the Warren Buffett model with a podcast to do 5 years because that's,
yeah,
you know, that's an eternity in the life of a podcast. But yeah, it was getting to a point where I'm doing bonus episodes, a transcription service that I can take and turn into blogs, and then you know, looking into doing, and like you said, what you're doing with yours, an actual video feed, which so far I think is probably going to be the easiest one because I can. You've got companies like Twitch and things like that now where I can just, you know, like we're doing now, hop on mic and record straight from there where there's actual video coming in.
Yeah.
So
it's a new world. It's a bright new world.
Yes, it's exciting. It's exciting for old dogs like us.
Yeah, exactly.
Though I don't consider myself old. So, well, cool. So we're kind of getting close to our time here. And I wanted to, get you to name drop because when you sent over your bio sheet, you had a list of very impressive people that you've worked with. So if you wouldn't mind just, you know, doubly legitimizing yourself with some selfless or with some shameless self-promotion of who you've had the opportunity to work with, that would be awesome.
Yeah. So from my original life in the kind of music industry, I've worked with everyone from members of the Rolling Stones, multiple kind of Grammy award winners, and some of these names people, you know, depending on the kind of style people music people are into, but like guys like mm-hmm. Paul Gilbert, who's Mr. Big, the band Mr. Big. Mm-hmm. I work with people like Tommy. I managed an artist called Tommy Emmanuel, who's very, very successful in the guitar, in that guitar world as well. And it's interesting because Friday, the other day, I was supposed to be down at a show with one of our artists, and it was a special kind of gig we were doing in London, and it was with Bill Wyman from Rolling Stones, Mark mm-hmm. Knopfler, Van Zandt from Springsteen's band.
Okay.
And I'm trying to remember all the other names. It was just the most ridiculous kind of guest list, and I couldn't make it, unfortunately. And so I got a message back and from one of the artists saying, "Oh, by the way, Bill says to say hello, and I hope you're doing well." And I did have to kind of stop and go, "Oh, okay. Remember the Rob?" And my wife had it not so long ago, actually, where we were working on something, and I was outside. I was maybe in the garden or something, and she came out and she picked up the phone, and she said, there was this very kind of deep American voice, and he said, "Oh, is James there? Can I speak to James, please?" And she said, "Oh, he's just sat in the garden. Let me just go and get him." She goes again. I came back. And it was George Benson.
And, oh, jeez.
And she said, "I can't believe I just spoke to George Benson." And but it's, and this is what's great as well with even with the podcast. You know, there's people I've had a chance to speak with on the podcast that may mean absolutely nothing, you know, to the general public, but I'm a huge fan of their mm-hmm. of their work, their creative work. People like Frederick Harren, who you may not have heard of, is probably one of the top creativity speakers and creativity in the world. He does about 80 things. He's based in Singapore now as well. He owns two private islands. And one of them, actually, he gives to for free. Anyone that wants to go to his island for 2 weeks to work on their creative ideas, they can go there and stay on his island off the coast of Sweden, I believe. And he has another one, I think, off near in the Philippines somewhere. And so
off the coast of Sweden, we're talking back into the cold desolation that breeds creativity again.
Exactly, it's that same thing. And then just other people that I'm just, you know, I'm a fan of their writing, like guys like Chris Guillebeau I've had on the show. What I love about Chris is an incredibly good marketer, but he has a really good heart. I don't know how many of our listeners today will know Chris Guillebeau, but wrote the $100 Startup, has a has an incredible live event up in Portland, up in Oregon, called, and I've now forgotten the name of the event. It's they have about 3,000 creative people, you know, remarkable people come and attend this event every year as well. Folks like Rolf Potts, who wrote a very influential book on a lot of travelers called Vagabonding, and who's actually very influential to Tim Ferriss. Tim really looked up to Rolf's writing. So yeah, it's just been amazing. It's been an amazing kind of journey in the chance of meeting some of these people.
So cool. Well, so wrapping up, where can people find you online?
So the best place to go is probably the website, to go to jamestaylor.me.me. You can find links to everything from there. And if you're into the kind of Twitter thing, then just I'm at jamestaylor_me as well. They're the best.
So as not to be confused with that other less famous
which
James Taylor.
Has happened because I worked with Luis Conte a while back, and Luis Conte is a percussionist with the James Taylor, and also with Phil Collins and Madonna, and I called up his house and I spoke to his wife. I got his wife on the phone and I said, it's James Taylor here to speak to Luis. And she said, listen to my voice, this strange English sounding voice. And she was like, really? Really?
Different James Taylor.
Different one. The one with the hair. So,
good point.
Yeah. So I've yet to meet him, but I have had the occasional hotel upgrades because people have mistaken us, but which is nice.
Hey, you know, take it where you can get it, right?
Exactly.
Now if they'll start upgrading you to first class on the flights because of that too, that would be even better.
That would be very, very nice indeed.
Yes. Well, James, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Since you have such a beautiful accent compared to the flat Midwestern accent that I have.
No, I love America. This is funny thing. Us Brits, we love American accents. And some reason, Americans like our accents, which is pretty cool.
Well, yours has a melody to it. You know, and I'm sure, you know, the UK is so diverse in the way the accents sound. Whereas, I mean, not that the States don't have diverse accents where, you know, you've got, you know, Boston, New York, New England, that there's a series of different accents there. And then you've got the Southern accent. But the rest of the country has this very just kind of neutral, flat accent but the UK has, you know, like you with being from Scotland, you've got that almost lilt to it where it's poetic.
It's a bit of a twang there.
Yes. It's a better twang than the Southern accent. Say that having lived in the South for, close to 30 years now. So, but if you wouldn't mind taking us out, we end every podcast by saying go out and hug some necks.
Go out and hug some necks.
Perfect. Thank you, James. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Jason.
You can find out more about James on Twitter at JamesTaylor_me. And be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at CreativeSOPod and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CreativeSouthGA or over at CreativeSouth.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Visit jack.ink/design and get up to $75 off your next order when you use promo code CSPodcast16. For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. Don't forget to head over to CreativeSouthGA.com right now to pick up your tickets for Creative South in April of 2017. We're looking forward to seeing you there and hugging some necks. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at Patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.